San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
Good evening, everybody. It's actually just Richard. Joe taking a little break this Saturday evening, so it's Richard Muzio all by himself, without the inimitable Joe Vecchio on. It's Your Money and Your Life. And as part of a continuing series regarding the Servant Leadership Institute's upcoming 5th Annual National Conference, which is on March 9th and 10th in lovely Coronado, California, at the Coronado Marriott, we've got a very special guest on the line who's going to be on the keynote panel at that event, and that would be the internationally best-selling author, Dr. Ken Blanchard. Dr. Blanchard, how are you this evening?
Well, good. I'm doing just great.
I really appreciate you being on the show, and I know we're a couple weeks away here from this big, big event down at the Coronado Marriott for Servant Leadership Institute, and our good friend Art Barter, who was a recent guest here on this show. Just curious, how did you become familiar with Art Barter and the work that he's doing at Servant Leadership Institute?
Well, I got to know Art through a thing that we had started called Vision San Diego, that we were trying to see what we could do to make San Diego really America's finest city, as a lot of people know. And Art got involved early on, and then I found out about his whole interest in servant leadership and the Institute. So I just think the world is in desperate need of a different leadership role model. We've seen what self-serving leaders have done in every sector of society and not very helpful. So Art and I are soulmates, I think.
That's a good way to put it. So I know you gained international acclaim with one of the all-time best-selling books in history called The 1 Minute Manager. And that was quite some time ago. Can you give us some brief background on how that book came to be and how that concept came to you? It's one of the best leadership and management books I've ever read.
Well, you know, life is what happens to you, as you know, when you're planning on doing something else. Mm-hmm. I was a college professor, you know, and I taught for 10 years and taught leadership and organizational behavior, had a textbook and all. And came out here on a sabbatical leave for 1 year to San Diego from University of Massachusetts. And after a couple of months, my wife said, "Why are we going back to Massachusetts? You know, summer in Massachusetts is 6 weeks of bad skating, although, you know, they got 6 or 7 inches of feet of snow up there right now."
Yeah, it's amazing.
But we early on, while we were here, we decided to stay. We were invited to a cocktail party that Adelaide Bree, who was an author in town, had for authors in San Diego, and somehow we qualified because of my textbook. And so Spencer Johnson was there, and I don't know if you know it, Spencer was a children's book writer. He wrote a whole series of kids' books years ago called Value Tales.
Right.
And the value of curiosity, the story of Christopher Columbus, the value of honesty, the story of Abe Lincoln. So my wife met Spencer first at this party, and she hand-carried him over to me, and she said, "You guys ought to write a children's book for managers. They won't read anything else." And that was our introduction, and Spencer was working on a kind of a one-minute parenting, one-minute scolding with a psychiatrist, and I invited him to a seminar, and he sat in the back and laughed and came running up at the end and said, "Forget parenting, let's do the one-minute manager." And we met the first week in November, and we had a first draft of that book going to the Rose Bowl at the end of December.
I mean, oh, wow.
That book wrote us, and then we self-published it because we knew we weren't known in New York, and they would beat us up and take all the money. So we self-published it, sold 25,000 copies with no advertising, except from, you know, my clients and stuff like that. And so then when we went to New York, they seem to be much more interested. And so we're actually coming out with a new one-minute manager in May. We've never redone the book or even had an e-book in 30-plus years. And we discovered, of course, that the one-minute manager, the concepts are still great and the story's great, but the whole style was much more command and control. And today it's much more side-by-side leadership, and we actually even changed the one-minute reprimand, the third secret, to one-minute redirect. So it's a whole different tone of the new one-minute manager.
I was wondering, you know, given that 1 minute now is an eternity, whereas 30 years ago, 1 minute wasn't. Everything moves faster in sound bites. Is it still 1 minute?
Should be 30 seconds, but it's still 1 minute.
Okay, gotcha. That's funny. But I know that book, I think it came out in 1982. It's literally been on the best-selling list now for going on over 30 years, which is
it's
incredible.
Pretty amazing, yeah.
Just so you say the new version coming out, you said, in May?
In May, yes.
Okay. We'll have you back on when the book is scheduled to release so we can promote it some more for you.
It's actually going to be called The New One-Minute Manager, yeah.
Okay. Neat stuff. So you're going to be presenting out here, I know, as well as on a panel with, Stephen M. Arcovey and John Maxwell on March the 9th. Is this the first time the three of you have been on a panel together?
No, we've been on panels at different times, not all three of us.
Okay.
I've been on panels with John Maxwell in places, and as well as, you know, Stephen M. R., but the three of us have never been together, which is really exciting because I have the highest respect for both of them. I was a good buddy with Stephen M. R.'s dad, and boy, he is just as good as his dad, and is doing really great stuff. So and Maxwell's always pushing the envelope, so it's going to be fun.
Yeah, first time ever. We've been telling everybody, first time ever the three of you are appearing simultaneously and all together.
Yes.
And it's going to be fun, whoever the moderator is. I assume that's Art himself.
Yes.
But so that's going to be a fun job. It won't even be a job. That'll just be pure fun for him. So I notice you now call yourself the Chief Spiritual Officer for the Ken Blanchard Company. What does the Chief Spiritual Officer do on a daily basis? I'm just curious.
Well, I tell you, a number of years ago, I had lunch with Max Dupree, who was the legendary chairman of Herman Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Max, what's your job as chairman of this great company? And he said, Ken, I have to be like a third-grade teacher. I have to say the vision and values over and over and over again till people get it right. And so I never liked the concept of being chairman. You know, my wife was president, and then her brother became president of our company. We got over 300 people in an office in Toronto and London and in Singapore. But my wife heads up the Office of the Future, and they were studying what created spirit in a workplace. And I thought, wow, that's what I need to be, is the Chief Spiritual Officer. So it's not, you know, necessarily about faith, but it's about how do we keep our purpose and our vision, our values out front of us constantly so we're committed to what we're doing and making a difference. Because that all the research on employee engagement says that that's one of the most important factors, that people have something bigger than themselves to serve. So that's what I remind them of. I leave a morning message every single day for everybody in our company. So it's a kind of a fun thing.
Yeah, in fact, when we called you the first time to get you online here, we got your answering machine. I love the message. So glad we tracked you down, too, or we would have had some dead air. But so anyway, question about how leadership has changed. I started in the business world in 1980 when I was all of 21 years old. And as you mentioned earlier, it was very much a command and control environment. I now find myself working in all kinds of different collaborative relationships where sometimes you're the leader, sometimes you're the follower. How have things changed since you wrote The One-Minute Manager more than 30 years ago in terms of the major changes that leaders should be sensitive to?
Well, I think the big changes is that the people, particularly younger people, they couldn't believe that we used to call managers superiors, and there are people working for them, subordinate, you know, subordinary people. And
right.
We talked about the head of the department and the hired hands. We didn't even give them a head, you know, and people would say, what's your job? I'm in supervision, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, and, you know, the belief now is that everybody really can contribute and make a difference because of the whole information explosion with technology. No longer is all the information in the top management's office. In fact, everybody has access to information, and therefore what we really need to realize is that none of us, is one of my favorite sayings, is as smart as all of us, and that what we really need to do is find ways to empower people, involve them, seek their counsel and all, and then they are really committed to make a difference out there.
Yeah, and in terms of changing demographics, when I came up in the business world, there were very few women other than in positions of secretary and so on. Now we have a workforce that is maybe more than 50%. And then, of course, in terms of generations, the youngest generation, millennials and so on, they think differently than guys like me who were born in the 1950s think. And I just think changing demographics are so huge in terms of what leaders have to be sensitive to actually bring about positive change and you know, put forth a very positive culture with their companies, because I think the young people really want to do something that makes a difference in the world, not just make money, for example.
Yes, and that's why I think that Art's and my belief in John Maxwell and Stephen M. R., we all believe that servant leadership is the only way to get both great results and great human satisfaction. And it's interesting, you know, when I talk to people in business initially about servant leadership, they think I'm talking about the inmates running the prison or trying to please everybody.
Yeah, Dr. Berlancher, can you hold that thought? Because we've got to take a quick commercial break.
Sure.
But we're going to come back right there. We'll be right back with It's Your Money and Your Life. Everybody, sit tight. Welcome back, everybody. It's Your Money and Your Life. This is Richard Musio without my co-host Joe Vecchio for the evening, and we've got Dr. Ken Blanchard on the line. Again, we're talking about the upcoming Servant Leadership Institute National Conference at the Coronado Marriott on March 9th and 10th, servantleadershipinstitute.com. Dr. Blanchard, thanks for hanging in there with us. When we went to break, we were talking about some people saying, well, servant leadership is really about the inmates running the asylum, and how could that possibly ever work?
Yeah, or trying to please everybody, mm-hmm. or some kind of religious movement. But what they don't understand is that there's two parts of servant leadership. One is vision and direction. In other words, people have to have something to serve, and so you need to know what business you're in, what's your picture of the future, where you're trying to accomplish, what are your values to guide your journey, and what are your goals. And that's the leadership part of servant leadership. And it's the responsibility of the traditional hierarchy to make sure that that is clear. And if that isn't clear, you know, like I wrote a paper, I tried to get to Obama and Romney and all these people about why Washington's such a mess, because we don't have any vision, mm-hmm. or values that we agree upon in this country anymore. And if there's nothing to serve, the only thing you get to serve is yourself. And so you've got to start with the leadership part of servant leadership. And once people are clear on where you're heading and what you're trying to accomplish and what are the values that guide your journey, now philosophically you turn that pyramid upside down, and now you get to the servant part of servant leadership, where now what you're trying to do is help everybody live according to the vision and accomplish the goals. You work for them. And boy, that's really talking about implementing side-by-side leadership, because it's not about everybody sucking up the hierarchy and thinking all the brains are up there. The belief is that we can really solve problems here, and your job is to cheerlead us on and help guide us in the direction that we need to go. But it's a whole different game. So it's the leadership part, which is vision and direction and goals, and then the servant part, which is how do you get that? But you got to philosophically turn that pyramid upside down when you do that. And when Jesus washed the feet of the disciples, he was transitioning from vision and direction to implementation. He had kind of a slow group, so it took him quite a long time to realize why he was here. But when he knew he was going to leave physically, he had to transition them to take over. So that's what that was there.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. One of the other things that I find fascinating about servant leadership is it expands, I would say, the definition of who the constituents of a business or an enterprise are. Typically, we would think of them as being shareholders or trying to maximize economic return to shareholders, and then maybe the team members, employees, the staff, whatever term you wish to use. But now it also encompasses bringing in other constituents like vendors, the community itself, the environment, governmental agencies, and so on.
Yeah.
And I just think that's really neat, because it's very clear that business doesn't just affect the company's owners or customers.
And what we find with all the great companies that get this you know, whether you're talking about Southwest Airlines, whether you're talking about Chick-fil-A, whether you're talking about Wegmans in the grocery business, Nordstrom in retail, Synovus in financial services, Disney in entertainment, is they think their number one customer is their people. And if they empower their people, encourage their people, train their people, they'll go out of the way to take care of their number two most important customer, the people they serve, mm-hmm. which is not only the people that use their products and services, you say, but you're also talking about the suppliers, the citizens, you know, all the different groups. And then if they do a really good job there, those people are going to brag on you, and that's going to take care of the third most important customer, which is the owners and the people who have the financial thing. But what happens is very often Wall Street and the pressures of all act like the most important thing is to make money, and then your customers might be important, but your people are dispendable, and that just doesn't work in the long run.
No, I agree. And yeah, you obviously see short-term focus on Wall Street, you know, things like quarterly results. Your point about why government doesn't work, I think one reason why government in this country no longer works is because everybody's trying to get elected next term and nobody's thinking two or three generations down the road.
That's right.
About what kind of world we're leaving for our children, our grandchildren. It's, I just need to get elected again in 2 years.
That's right.
And, you know, it just doesn't bode well for what I guess you would call legacy. And that's unfortunate. So can you give us some advance notice about what you might be talking about at Servant Leadership Institute, or what you expect the panel to be like?
Well, I think Gardor is always pushing us, you know, about, you know, Warren Bennis, whenever I saw him, and he passed away recently, mm-hmm. always say, Ken, what has come clear to you since we last talked? And, you know, one of the things that's come clear to me, I'm thinking about working on a book entitled, Duh, Why Isn't Common Sense Common Practice, you know, because yeah. as I say, when I look at the companies that are leading in their fields, they all get what Art Barter and the Servant Leadership Institute and Maxwell and Covey and all of us are talking about, and why don't the rest of them get that, you know? And so that's really one of the things I really want to talk to John and Steve and MR about is, you know, what's your experience? Why aren't more people getting it? I mean, I think we're making some progress, but it you'd say, why would you think more people would get it, you know?
Yeah, I love that title because I've had a couple of customer services experiences where I just leave shaking my head.
Yes.
Say, you know, somebody says, well, we can't do that because that's company policy. And I reply, well, isn't company policy to take good care of your customer?
Yes. You know, and
they're like, well, no, that's not what the rules say.
I always get, people get a big kick because I always end up somehow talking about, you can tell a company run by self-serving leaders because as a frontline of people, you're dealing with ducks, not eagles, and they're going quack, quack, it's yeah. our policy, quack, quack. Right. I just work here, you know. And where if you're dealing with a great company, you're dealing with an eagle who soars above the crowd and says, I'll take care of it. I'll get back to you. Good point. Let me see what I can do about that.
Yeah, it's such a big difference. Mark Twain once said that the most dangerous thing is what we know that just ain't so. And so many companies, I think they know what they know, but they just aren't in tune with their customers or their constituents.
Yeah,
so they think they know something, but it isn't true.
No, that's the duh.
Right, you know, that's the duh part. So, hey, personal question. I know you're an avid golfer. Is it true that you belong to a golf club in Scotland?
Yes, we actually dropped out recently, but we belong to Loch Lomond.
Okay.
Where they always played the Scottish Open.
Sure,
before,
the Scottish, yeah.
Before. And we got into that when they were just opening it, and what a fabulous course. And I've played all over Scotland and Ireland, and it's just fun to go back where the game started, you know, and just to do it. And, you know, the weather's always unpredictable. I remember my wife and I coming up the 18th in Turnberry, and mm-hmm. we had played completely in a downpour the whole 18th. And she looked at me and said, why are we doing this? And I says, it's Scotland.
Yeah, well, I guess if you can play that course, you better go play that course.
Yes, it's wonderful. We enjoy it, solely enjoy it. And the Scottish people are wonderful. They're
absolutely.
Just fun to be around.
So what else do you have on your agenda? I know you've got the new book coming out in May. What are your plans for after that, if I may ask?
Well, I have a book that just came out that's catching a real chord that I might talk a little bit about.
Okay, sure.
They're called Refire, Don't Retire, Make the Rest of Your Life the Best of Your Life, that I did with Mort Shavitz, who's mm-hmm. a psychology professor here at UC San Diego. And it's hit a real chord with people because when I was 65, a number of years ago, I was on the phone with old Zig Ziglar, the motivation
sure.
guy, and he had invited my wife and I to the 59th anniversary of his 21st birthday. I said, Ziggy, you got to retire. He said, there's no mention of it in the Bible except for Jesus, Mary, and David.
Yeah.
Nobody under 80 made an impact. I'm refiring, not retiring. And so I just got excited about that concept and what does refiring mean? And so what Mort and I are asking people to do is look at what are you doing to refire intellectually to keep your mind active?
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing emotionally, relationships? Are you in a rut? You're doing the same thing with the same people in the same way, having lunch with the same group of people at work and all that. What are you doing physically to keep yourself in shape so you can go? And then finally, spiritually, what are you doing there? Not in terms of a religion, but, you know, what's your purpose in life? What are you trying to accomplish? And how do you get your ego out of the way? Realize you're here to serve rather than be served. And so that's been an exciting venture.
Yeah, and a neat thing I've noticed, a lot of people say around age 65, that, you know, their careers are over, but they still want to work, or in some cases have to, but they want to, I think in some cases, in many cases, do something different and maybe a little bit more meaningful than what they had been used to for the last 20, 30, 40 years. Because there's obviously a great need in the workplace for talented people, and of course the wisdom that people of the baby boomer generation offer is just incredible.
Yes, and well, we're working on some ways that companies could take advantage of the wisdom of older people who could be mentors for younger people, but also help them, train and get people younger to be ready, but mm-hmm. don't just set them off in the sunset. But how can you use that wisdom and that power and not lose it, maybe not in a full-time way, but in a way that makes a difference? And then people, Mort's research on aging says that the most happy people are the people who retire to something, not from something.
Right, exactly. Hey, Dr. Blanchard, we really, really appreciate your time. We've got to take our bottom of the hour break. But we look forward to seeing you out at the Servant Leadership Institute conference on March 9th and 10th. And again, very, very much appreciate your time and your insights.
Well, thank you. And I think the conference is going to be fabulous and people ought to come. And I'm a big fan of Art Barter and the whole Datron and what they're trying to do in this area. Maxwell and Stephen M. R. are fabulous. So the worst it can be is unbelievable.
Very much appreciate it. Thanks again.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.